Welcome to Health Cetera in the Catskills on WIOX Radio. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program, where we focus on the impact of local, state, national, and global issues on the health of the individuals, families, and communities in the Central Catskill region. Health Cetera in the Catskills is broadcast from the WIOX radio station in Roxbury, New York, which is the ancient and unceded territory of the Esopus clan of the Lenni Lenape people, also known as the Munsee, who were the first caretakers living with this land. Today, we live in the influence of what is now called the Lenni Lenape Nation of the Northeastern Woodlands in the United States and Canada. Their territory includes present-day northeastern Delaware, New Jersey, and eastern Pennsylvania, along the Delaware River watershed, New York City, western Long Island, and the lower Hudson Valley. And I want to do a shout-out to Teokas and Ghost Horse for that incredible interview on First Voices Radio that we just heard. Just really, really important work by Teokas and Ghost Horse. Really moving. Well, later in today's Health Cetera program, I'm going to be talking with a respiratory therapist at Margaretville Hospital about some classes for people who have respiratory problems. So if you or someone you know has some respiratory problems, whether emphysema, COPD, asthma, other kinds of respiratory conditions, you might want to pay attention to what is being offered for free at Margaretville Hospital. But first, I've talked a lot about palliative care and end-of-life care on Health Cetera over the years that I've been doing this program. As a nurse, a friend, a daughter, and now a wife, I've been with many people who were either dealing with end-of-life decisions or actively dying. Most recently, my husband, James Jabouware, whose music opens this program, suffered a major stroke on Christmas night. He was 80 years old and had seen both his mother and grandmother have strokes and linger in distress for months. He didn't want to die that way. We had many discussions about his preferences about treatment for life-threatening illnesses, and I was his healthcare proxy. And so it was important to me to know what he wanted for end-of-life care and what he didn't want. So when he had the stroke, I knew what I needed to do, what he would have wanted. So instead of aggressive treatment, I requested a palliative care consult, and we proceeded to withhold anything that would not support his dying in comfort. He died 4 days later, experiencing a death that really was profound, and that's a whole other story. But I had to do battle with the healthcare system and even my fellow nurses to make sure that he died in comfort and with dignity. And this was actually very traumatic for me. When he was transported to the hospital after the stroke, and it was about an hour and a half away, he was unable to speak. He was paralyzed on his right side. He was barely conscious. I was asked by, as I was driving to the hospital, I was 10 minutes away, and I was asked by what is called an interventional neurologist for permission to try to remove the blood clot in his brain. Now, it had been many hours that it was not like within the first hour after he had the stroke. If that's the case, there are clot-busting drugs that can be tried, and actually, you can have a really good outcome. But he had likely had the stroke probably 8 hours before I found him. And so the neurologist said, and he described himself as a plumber. This is the interventional neurologist. He said, you know, I'm the plumber. He wanted my permission to try to remove the blood clot in his brain. And while there was a piece of me that said, oh, don't do it, and I had pulled over to the side of the road to have this conversation, I said, go ahead, give it a try. But he is a DNR, a do not resuscitate. And the neurologist replied, we'll discuss that when you get here. Well, when I got to the hospital, the neurologist told me he had had difficulty removing the clot, but had gotten it out. And I must say that he was worse after that clot was removed. With the neurologist, I discussed my husband's wishes. I signed the do not resuscitate form. And then the neurologist asked me whether I would give permission for my husband to be intubated. That's putting a tube into his lungs to help him breathe if he had difficulty breathing for reasons other than a cardiac arrest. And he wanted this permission. I was very hesitant. And he said, well, why don't we start with 30 days? And I told him, you can have permission for 3 days and then we'll revisit it. But I want a palliative care consult. And he replied, oh, we're not there yet. And I said, palliative care is not just end-of-life care. He said I was right, but he never made the referral. When I came in the next morning, I had to get some things straightened up at home. I came back to the hospital. I found my husband being tube-fed. That's a tube going from his nose into his stomach. And I was told it was to administer medications, but he was receiving a feeding via that tube. And I knew what track this train was on, and I was determined to get him off of it. I demanded a palliative care consult immediately. A wonderful palliative care nurse practitioner came up, had a conversation with me, spent a good bit of time with me, actually say, I want to thank you for having the courage to make this decision now. And we took him off the aggressive treatment, moved him to a regular floor. That's a whole other story. But the point being that his wishes were then being put into play. And being an advocate for my husband, I had to be there. I didn't leave his side after that. And being an advocate was not easy. And I'm a nurse with very strong feelings about the over-medicalization of dying and the suffering that often accompanies it. So how does someone who is not a nurse or a health professional be an advocate for their loved one, whether a family member or a friend, when they're diagnosed with an advanced illness or they're facing dying? Well, Robin Bennett Kanarek is a registered nurse, but she has written a book that can guide lay people in understanding what palliative care is and how to advocate for using it for a serious illness. It's titled Living Well with a Serious Illness, A Guide to Palliative Care for Mind, Body, and Spirit. And the book is published by John Hopkins Press. And I'm delighted to welcome Robin Bennett Kanarek to Health Center in the Catskills. Robin, thank you so much for joining me today on Health Center in the Catskills to talk about this important issue. Robin, did I lose you? All right.
Are you there?
I'm there.
I'm so sorry. It is such an honor and a pleasure to be here and to talk to your audience. Thank you so much for having me, Diana. And I'm also so sorry to hear about the passing of your husband and the experience that you went through. My heart is right there with you.
Yeah, I know it is. Thank you. So, Robin, talk about why you wrote this book.
I lost a son, David, when he was 15 years old to complications from a stem cell transplant from leukemia. He was diagnosed when he was 10, and he did very well for several years. We thought he was on the road to recovery, and then he relapsed, and his leukemia diagnosis was more dire. And we could not do a bone marrow transplant because we couldn't find a perfect match for him. And we finally, Memorial Sloan Kettering was the only institution. This is in 1999. Sloan was the only institution in the nation who would do a very new procedure called a T-cell depletion to minimize complications from a perfect match, and our daughter was the donor. Unfortunately, he developed complications still, and 8 months after he had the transplant, he passed away. And soon after, I couldn't stay in the East Coast anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I was going east, I was going to Yale New Haven. If I was going west, I was going to Sloan Kettering. Mm-hmm. And after his death, I just decided we needed a new beginning. And there was a job opportunity for Joe in London, so we moved to London.
Joe is
and
your husband?
Joe is my mm-hmm. husband of 43 years. Mm-hmm. And we moved to London, and that's when I really had the time to reflect on what I had been through, what our family went through, and how we could have improved care. And soon after, I got involved with some organizations, and I started writing. And I started writing articles in nursing journals and medical journals to educate my colleagues on what could have changed, how his care could have improved. And eventually, in 2019, I decided I needed to really educate the consumer because there were no books on this topic. And there might be a chapter on palliative care, but there wasn't a comprehensive book. So the main reason I wrote the book was to honor David's memory. That's foremost, and to create a legacy for him. And David would have wanted me to share this. And I just found that this was a topic that had to be addressed, and I was the person to do it.
Well, I think you were right. It's a very good book. So we, as I mentioned at the outset, we've talked a lot about palliative care on this program, but, you know, somebody may not have caught those programs, or people may forget. So let's start with talking about what is palliative care.
Sure. Palliative care is a relatively new specialty. It's been around since the 40s. Dame Cicely Saunders in London started the first hospice movement. And palliative care was happening around the same time, but it didn't become an approved subspecialty in the United States until 2006. It's a very specialized medical care for people living with a serious illness. This type of care is focused on providing relief from the symptoms and the stress of the illness. And the goal is to improve quality of life for both the patient and their family, and to decrease the burden from a serious illness and its treatment. I think one thing people need to be aware of is that people with a serious illness can live for many, many years with their condition if they're well supported and have a multidisciplinary team to address their needs and concerns. And a multidisciplinary team consists of doctors, nurses, physician's assistants, social workers, chaplains, and other specialists who will work together with the patient's primary care physician to provide an extra layer of support to the patient and to their family. Palliative care is based on the needs of the patient and not their prognosis. Mm-hmm. It's appropriate at any age and at any stage of serious illness, and it is provided along with curative treatment. Mm-hmm. And that can even happen at the time of diagnosis if needed. Palliative care is meant to enhance a person's current care by focusing on quality of life for them and their family. Some of palliative care programs vary from hospital to hospital, but it includes psychosocial and spiritual care for the patient and family, and management of symptoms such as pain, fatigue, shortness of breath, depression, constipation, and nausea. It also provides support for complex decisions, such as discussions of goals of care, do not resuscitate orders, and requests for treatment. And it also includes the coordination of care across various healthcare settings.
So, Robin, let me just ask you, for how does this differ, if you would speak to how it differs from hospice?
Sure. People are choosing hospice at the end of life. Hospice focuses on care, comfort, and quality of life for the person with a serious illness who is approaching end of life. And usually end of life is 6 months or less. Mm-hmm. And at some point, it's not possible to cure serious illness, or a patient may not want to undergo extreme treatment. And hospice is designed for this situation. Mm-hmm. The patient will begin hospice care understanding that their illness is not responding to medical care and or to cure it or to slow down the disease process. And a physician has to order hospice care order.
You know, it's been my experience, and you do speak to this in the book, that many physicians equate palliative care with the hospice care. And it's like the neurologist said to me, we're not there yet. Well, yes, we are. We're very much there. So talk about why else palliative care isn't offered more often.
I think there are many reasons for this, and I'll give you a general idea. There's major confusion between the distinction between palliative and hospice care. So many times they're put together and people will think, oh, if you're suggesting palliative care, then I must be dying. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case at all. There's a new movement, I would say in the past 10 years, that has really distinctly made this distinction between palliative care and hospice care. People are also not familiar with the term palliative. Mm-hmm. And palliative means to cloak, to relieve the symptoms of the disease. Mm-hmm. I think that is a big reason. People have no idea what the word means. Mm-hmm. Culturally, we live in a culture that denies death and dying. Yeah. People don't want to talk about it. So that is also an issue. But I think a lot of physicians fear that patients will perceive palliative or hospice care a failure on their part. And this has nothing to do with it. I mean, we are all going to die. It's just a matter of realizing what the patient is being confronted by. And the doctor needs to understand that we as the family understand that there's a limit as to how much medicine can do. But 99% of clinicians claim that it is very necessary to have a difficult conversation with their patients, but only 14% of them understand that they acknowledge that they don't have the skills to start this conversation. So the number one issue is education and simulation. I think education, I mean, not only from the doctor, but for nurses, all healthcare providers need to be educated on this. And the consumer needs to be given the tools so they can start this conversation with their doctor. Because when our son was dying, when he was at New York Presbyterian and he was in the intensive care unit, no one had this discussion with me, and I had to bring it up to the resident saying, I need you to tell me when we're at the state of no return, meaning when we're going to be doing more harm than good. Mm-hmm. And he finally acknowledged that the outcomes for David were not good and that he would need multiple transplants if he were to survive this. And that's when we decided to put David as a DNR. Prior to that, we did not. And he died a few hours later, very quietly, and it was just, his heart just stopped. And I have to say, it was a very difficult decision, but I knew it needed to be done.
Robin, if you would, you describe in the book about how your son at one point was very agitated.
Yes.
And you wanted the physician to talk with him. Could you share that? I think it's a very powerful story.
Oh, it changed my life. David, when he was, after he had his stem cell transplant, he was in strict isolation for several weeks because his immune system was wiped out and we introduced a new immune system, which was our daughter's. And it was going to take several weeks for his platelet count to improve so that he could fight an illness or bacteria. One week after he was in strict isolation, his behavior, his his personality changed dramatically. He was very confrontational, not only to the staff, but to my husband and I. He was angry. He was depressed. He was having difficulty sleeping. And in my gut, and this is as a nurse and as a mom, I had a gut feeling that he had fears of his own mortality. And from my study in nursing school going back to the 70s, Dr. Kubler-Ross, who was the death and dying doctor, she outlined that in one of her books on children who are dying, that children many times do not want to talk to their parents about their own fears of death because they don't want to burden their parents anymore. So I recognized this, and I called, asked for a psychiatrist to go in, and there was only one child psychiatrist at the institution at that time, and he went in with a very Freudian standpoint about what David was going through, and David eventually fired him. This was a 15-year-old, said, "You're not helping me in any way," and he fired the doctor. But then, although this was kind of amusing, it was also really serious, because who was David going to talk to? And I asked the nurses, I asked the doctors, what is going on with David? Why is his personality so different? And they all had the same answer. We see this all the time in children who are undergoing transplants, but they didn't take it a step further. And that's where I felt they did a disservice. So finally, he had one doctor who really had a great relationship with David, and we begged him to go in to talk to David, and he was really reluctant to have this conversation. But I gave him no choice. I said, "You have to go in." And he did. And 3 hours later, Diana, he came out totally exhausted and said, "Your son had a lot of philosophical questions." And he walked away. I mean, he absolutely had enough. And so my husband and I walked into the room. We gowned up and went in and expected David to be very depressed. And it was shockingly just the opposite. David had a smile on his face. And I couldn't believe the change of being validated, having all his feelings validated. And fast forward 20 years, for 20 years, I had no idea what David was still going through because no one had addressed it. And it wasn't until I heard Dr. Christina Pukowski from George Washington University, who works at the Institute of Spirituality and Health, she gave a presentation at Fairfield University, which is the nursing school I graduated from, and she gave a presentation on spiritual distress. And she described how it would manifest itself in an adult. And she said, oh, they would be depressed, they'd be angry, they would be confrontational, belligerent. And she went on to describe spiritual distress. And at the end of the presentation, I stood up and I said, this is exactly what my 15-year-old son went through, but no one addressed it as spiritual distress. Now it all makes total sense to me. So from that point on, I then decided to write a paper on it for the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management. And it was published. This is a very prestigious journal, for mostly for doctors, but it's for anybody. But it outlined what we went through with our son having a stem cell transplant and how spiritual distress was the cause of this personality change.
It's an amazing story, and you've just been listening to Robin Bennett Kanarek, who's the author of Living Well with a Serious Illness, A Guide to Palliative Care for Mind, Body, and Spirit, published by Johns Hopkins Press. I'm Diana Mason. You're listening to Health Cetera in the Catskills on WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20. also at 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org. So let's talk about what people can do to get palliative care. It's so important, and yet being in the healthcare system can be so intimidating. So what do you tell people about when and how to ask for palliative care, and how to advocate for what they or their loved one may need?
Wonderful question, Diana. I think people need to learn about the benefits of palliative care and how it improves quality of life. And I think as people learn more about palliative care, they will embrace it and advocate for it. Diane Meyer, who's a palliative care physician out of Mount Sinai Hospital and the past president of Center for Palliative Care, says in a lot of cases, you're going to have to demand it.
Yeah.
I have a friend who has a very serious lung issue, and she was being seen at a very large facility in California. And she told me that she wanted palliative care because we've had many conversations about how it can improve your quality of life. And she brought it up to her doctor, the pulmonologist. And the doctor was extremely relieved that she brought it up to him, and he agreed that she needed it, and she got it immediately. A lot of hospitals with over 50 beds will have some form of palliative care program, but each hospital implements it differently and in their own way. But as I mentioned before, it's the physician, nurse practitioner, physician's assistant, nurse, social worker, and chaplain who will start the whole process. But I just think you need to be proactive. You need to read. That's why this book was written, to educate you on what all that palliative care encompasses and how it can help you and provide that layer of support. But education's imperative.
And Robin, let me just point out that in the book, you do talk about some of the evidence behind palliative care and the fact that there is evidence showing that when somebody gets palliative care instead of or in as an accompaniment to aggressive treatment, that they actually live longer with a higher quality of life in some circumstances. And I think it's important for people to keep that in mind. I think too many people think, if I'm going to palliative care, I'm giving up. No, you're not. You're just looking to improve the quality of your life. And I also wanted to point out, you talked early on, excuse me, about part of what you do with palliative care is talk to the person about their goals for that they want. So for some people, it may be, I want to live the longest life that I can. Whereas for others, it may be, I want to live the best quality of life that I can. And that's very different. I have a friend who wants to live as long as she can, no matter what. And for other friends and for myself, it's I want a high quality of life. It's not the length of that life. So that's important for your healthcare providers to know. And I have to say that outside of palliative care, I'm not sure other healthcare providers know that. And one of the other things you point out in the book is that there should be, and there is this debate about it, but I think there is this effort to mainstream palliative care in terms of having all health professionals having some foundational understanding of the approaches to palliative care. Is that where you think it's going, that we're going to have most healthcare professionals have a better understanding of this, and then they'll refer to specialists as needed?
Absolutely. First of all, there aren't enough palliative care providers, and especially physicians. And I truly believe that it's the nurse who can really provide it holistically and do it on so many different levels. You were the president of the American College of Nursing, the AACN.
American Academy of Nursing.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
And they now endorse palliative care education and are establishing competencies and recommendations that will guide the education for future nurses caring for those with a serious illness. So I think nursing schools, number one, and medical schools have to incorporate the palliative care process into their experience. And the University of Pennsylvania is one of the first medical schools in the United States that is starting to incorporate palliative care into each year of the medical students' education. So they're going to get didactic education and they're going to get clinical education. And I have no doubt that medical schools will follow. But I think nurses are so, and Diane Meyer even admits that it's going to be nurses who are going to take the lead in this because the nurses see the whole patient. They see the psychological, the emotional, the medical, the physical, and the spiritual aspect of care. And where doctors are really siloed into curing. And nurses have a very different perspective.
Yes. Now, you also include in the book a discussion about having an action plan for when the end is near, but it's not even when the end is near. You talk about, and we've talked about that this here on HealthCetera, and even walk people through it, having an advanced directive or a living will, a healthcare proxy. Talk about the importance of this.
Oh, I think everyone needs to get their affairs in order while they're still healthy, because you never know when, unfortunately, tragedies do happen. There are car accidents, there are traumatic brain injuries, there are strokes, there are all sorts of things that can happen with having no idea that it's going to happen. So you need to get all your affairs in order. You need to think about the type of care you want if you were to get seriously ill or if you couldn't speak on your own behalf. You need to have a designated person to be your your proxy and to help speak on your behalf. You also need to think about what it is that you really, really want. And there's a document called Five Wishes that you can download from the computer. And that is a very simple, it's complicated, but the questions are easy, but you have to think. You have to really think what's important to you and to your family as to what you want. And so that's another very important aspect.
And Robin, if I could add, so I've been encouraging people to have a healthcare proxy, but and so you put that in writing. Now, nobody asked me as the wife for show me the healthcare proxy form. I think being the wife, the spouse, they assume that I'm the healthcare proxy, I think. However, for the most part, you do want a form. You want your primary care provider to have that form. And there's even a database in New York that you can deposit that form in or put a copy of it in. Not that the healthcare providers are going to take the time to look it up. However, I think the most important thing is the conversation with the person. So,
yes. So
you can never talk about all the scenarios, but what you want to know are those goals and what's important to them and what they don't want. Like I had with my husband, I knew that if he had a stroke, he did not want to go the way his mother and grandmother went. We had so many conversations about that. And I asked clarifying questions of him. I said, well, let's try this scenario. What would you want? So you can't anticipate everything, but if you've had the deep conversation with the person who you love, I'm a healthcare proxy for a friend. I love her. And I want to make the right decisions if I am asked to speak for her, if she's unable to make decisions for herself. But it's important to have that deep conversation so you're comfortable being that advocate. Is that on track?
Oh, absolutely. My father, who lived to be 102, died 2 years ago. And my biggest fear for him, and I was his advocate, and I did not want him to go to the hospital anymore. This is also during COVID. So I called the paramedics saying, if my father, because some of the nurses' aides, would call an ambulance if he was heading towards a danger zone where his blood pressure was dropping or whatever. Mm. And I constantly had to educate the nurses' aides that do not call 911. Yes. Because yes. if you call 911, yes. they're going to see, first of all, hopefully the DNR will be into their system. And that's number one. And so, but they will, unless you have the proxy right there, they're going to do mm-hmm. CPR on that person.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. And it doesn't do to tattoo it on your chest.
yep. And I think that's the one thing people need to be aware of. It's not only educating your family and your loved ones, but also people who are providing the care for your loved one may not be aware. So you have to sit down and talk to them. I also had to sit down and talk to my brothers because they had no idea about what was going on. And there can be problems between siblings. So we had to all get on the same page. It's a lot of work. Yeah. It's a lot of work. But I have to tell you, my father died very peacefully mm-hmm. with music playing. I was by his bedside, and I have to tell you, that brings me tremendous comfort yes. to know that he died peacefully.
Yes. And I feel the same way about how my husband died. I feel grateful that I was able to advocate for him and to help him through this last transition. I mean, we all want that, don't we?
Yes.
We want someone who's going to make sure that our end is as much the way we would like it to be as possible. We don't always have control, but when we do, what are we doing and how are we doing it? So in the time we have left, I want to talk about two other things. And one is, you know, from a policy perspective, and we're not going to have time to go into too many of these, but what kinds of policy changes do we need to enable palliative care to be more available to people when they need it and want it?
It's very costly to do palliative care. And palliative care, for the most part, is provided by donations, by philanthropic people. You've got the Cambia Foundation on the West Coast. You've got Robert Wood Johnson. They are all leading the way in palliative care, and they're doing a fabulous job. But we need to get more reimbursement for those people who are doing these services. And the reimbursement is very minimal. So there are legislators. There's Rosen in Nevada, Barrasso in Wyoming, Baldwin in Wisconsin, and Fisher in Nebraska, who are big advocates, who are bipartisan, and they want a specific palliative care payment model developed. And so that's where I'm hoping it's going to go. And I think once that is done, then more people will enter the field and will get reimbursement for their services.
Yeah.
Because hospitals right now want revenue.
And years ago, Aetna did an analysis. They gave people choices in what they really worked to give people choices in whether they wanted the aggressive treatment, whether they wanted hospice care, whether they wanted more of a palliative care approach. And they found that, indeed, most people wanted to die at home and they wanted to die in comfort, and that actually it saved money for the insurance company. Yeah.
It saves significant money, but you have to put the money out to educate all your healthcare providers so you're all on the same page. And then, but once you do that, you will save the health system and Medicare a lot of money.
That's not why you want to do it, but it's the argument if somebody says, oh, we can't afford to do this. Yes, you can. Yes, you can.
Yes, you can.
So finally, you have a foundation. Briefly tell us about your foundation.
Oh, thank you so much for asking. We started a family foundation in 2006, It's called the Kinnaric Family Foundation, and the purpose of it is, the mission is to improve the quality of life for those affected by cancer and any other serious life-threatening conditions through the promotion, education, integration of palliative care, and it's also, palliative care is also referred to as supportive care, into all areas of the field. The Kinnaric Family Foundation has been involved in many programs to improve care for those with a serious illness, and this was all really propelled by what we felt was lacking in our son's care, and that was the need to focus on psychosocial and the spiritual needs of a patient. The first project we did was at Fairfield University, integrating pediatric and adolescent palliative care into the nursing curriculum in 2006. So this was way ahead of the game. And this eventually led up to our creating a palliative care center for nurses at Fairfield University. And that was started in 2017. And it is thriving.
Good.
We also did a project with Memorial Sloan Kettering to educate pediatric nurses to have advanced communication skills so that they can follow the doctors with a bad diagnosis and support the family. And so that was a five-year project, and that has done very, very well.
And if people want to learn more about the foundation, you have a website?
Yes, I do.
Yes.
KinnaricFamilyFoundation.org.
And spell that, Kinnaric?
K-A-N-A-R-E-K, familyfoundation.org.
Excellent.
And I also have a personal website that highlights my book and everything in the book, and that's robinkinnaric.com.
Robin with an I, KANARIK.com. And we've been talking with Robin Bennett Kinnaric, who's the author of Living Well with a Serious Illness, A Guide to Palliative Care for Mind, Body, and Spirit. Robin is a registered nurse, and it's a wonderful, wonderful resource. Robin, thank you so much for providing the public with this resource. Thank you for coming on to Health Center in the Catskills.
Thank you so much, Diana. I really appreciate being on Health Et Cetera and on WIOX Radio.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, that's the end of Health Center in the Catskills. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program on WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains. Enjoy June and take an umbrella. Thank you.
WIOX is supported by you and the following community underwriters. What the Soap, WTS and Company, in Windham. For soaps and skincare products made on site, handcrafted candles, pottery, jewelry, art, and gifts, with a wide selection of books on homesteading, fermentation, and local history. Upcoming events at the WTS Facebook page, WTS and Company.